Okay, I think as we had that a couple of times already, we have 17 registered participants, and not all are yet here. Let's see who will join us a bit later. Anyway, I would suggest that we should start. I'm very pleased and happy to have Kim Gomez with us today in this webinar. In the preparation meeting, we agreed that I will give a very, very brief introduction to Kim's biography, but then she will herself give a little bit of her historical context, let's say, in the learning sciences and in the specific topic. So Kim received a Bachelor's of Arts from the University of Florida in speech pathology, and also a Master's of Florida State University, also in speech pathology, and then moved for another master's degree to the University of Chicago in educational psychology, where she also made her PhD in educational psychology a couple of years ago. I mean, her main focus in teaching and research is, or one of her focus points is the teaching and learning through the use of digital technologies and Web 2.0 environments across learning ecologies, and this is also the main topic of today. In addition, she's also working on supporting students with low literacy skills and non-English background learners access to developmental mathematics and statistics, and also middle and high school science curriculum development. So, Kim, we are very much looking forward. The papers were distributed, so we as participants read them, but we are very much looking forward to your self-introduction and then also to what you are going to discuss with us. Kim looks a little bit frozen, so maybe, well, if we start with a quick introduction round, Kim, I forgot about that one. So if we make a very quick introduction round of also the other participants, so that you and I and everyone knows who is participating so far in this webinar, that would be great.
Hi everyone, this is Phil Bell at the University of Washington, the Learning Sciences Program here. We have a couple different research groups represented today. Some of us have been involved actually working with the Remix platform with Nicole Pinker doing project-based work, and we're interested to do some comparisons across the initiatives. And generally the group thinks about science education in and out of school, and I'll hand it off to Veronica.
I'm Veronica McGowan, and I'm a grad student here at the Life Center. And this year, my research is looking at connecting science learning across settings using an app called Zydeco. And I'm interested in looking at how Remix could be used in that sort of context as well.
And I'm DM Nguyen, and I'm working on a project-based learning project here at the Life Center at University of Washington. We have just been exploring different platforms and technology that we can incorporate into our courses that we've developed and implemented in high schools, and so always curious to see what the different technologies are available out there.
Hi Kim, hi everyone, my name is Daniel. I'm a PhD student here at the LMU within the Reason program, and I'm interested into scientific reasoning and argumentation within the realms of mathematics education, and I'm planning to do an intervention studies which could also include digital learning technologies, and that's why I'm pretty interested into this webinar. So thanks in advance, Kim.
Hi, my name is Blake. I'm a master's student here at the LMU. My interests lie with online technologies and social media, so that's why I was interested in today's digital learning thing.
Hello, my name is David. I'm here a master's student as well. I'm doing learning sciences, and mostly I'm interested in business coaching and organizational psychology, but I'm here because I'm from Hungary and our education system isn't really good, and I would like to know what could be done there and how the next generation will learn.
So hi everyone, I'm Kim Gomez, and again, good morning from Los Angeles. And as Frank said, I started off my professional life as a person trained in clinical speech and language pathology. And you might wonder how I got from there to here. Much of that work is very goal-oriented, as you might imagine. It also, even when I was trained, used a significant number of technologies to try to understand what the presenting challenge was and how to address the challenge. And I needed to understand the affordances of the technologies, but more importantly, I needed to help my clients understand how to make uses of the technologies, whether at home or in the clinical setting with me. And over time, I became increasingly interested in the challenges of literacy and language and trying to figure out why there were the kinds of inequities that I was seeing with various clients that I was working with. And eventually did go back to get my master's and PhD from University of Chicago in educational psychology, where my focus there was very strictly on language and literacy and from an ethnographic perspective, learning how to gather information in homes and in communities around the ways that language and literacy was socialized into families and through talk. After that period, I did a postdoc at Northwestern University, and some of you may know about what I think of as the legendary Center for Learning Technologies and Urban Schools that was at Northwestern at that time. It was a very large NSF-funded program, and I was brought in as a postdoc ostensibly to do the ethnography for the Center for Learning Technologies and Urban Schools to document how they were designing curricular materials that were infused with instructional technologies that were pretty state-of-the-art instructional technologies at that time. And so I was brought in to document how those technologies were being designed and how the curricular materials associated with those technologies were being collaboratively designed with teachers, graduate students, and faculty members. And in the course of doing this ethnography, I began to what I think of as kind of put two and two together. Some teachers who were doing early pilots of this work were saying that they the instructional technologies were not accessible to them. That is, that the students were having difficulties really figuring out how to make use of the technologies. The curricular materials, though exceedingly good materials, were written at a level often inaccessible for the kids who were in the schools. Many of the kids in the schools, I think David might have mentioned being from Hungary. Correct me if I'm wrong. And in Chicago, particularly in the 90s, the school system was really abysmal in most of the places that one might go. 30% of the kids were reading at or above grade level, which is pretty horrible. In some cases, it was only 20% of the kids were reading at or above grade level. And yet the curricular materials, the science curricular materials that were being introduced into these schools were written at a grade level that was much higher than the kids could read. They were designed in such a way that the cognitive load for particular activities was demanding more than the kids and the teachers were able to work with. And so as a postdoc, I applied to the Joyce Family Foundation for a grant to try to understand how to redesign one example of those materials, which was the Behavior Matters curriculum led by, to see if we could take that curriculum and refine it such that it would be more accessible to kids who had low literacy skills and those who were non-English background learners. I worked collaboratively with a group of teachers and middle school teachers for about 6 months, going through every single lesson and trying to figure out what were the cognitive overloads in the lessons, what were the materials that were less accessible than they needed to be given the population they were working with, how explicit could we be with teachers so that pedagogically the teachers would understand how to do the scaffolding necessary to bring the students along so that the science could be accessible and that the language skills that kids had and the pedagogical skills that the teachers had would not serve as an impediment to kids learning the science. So we then after the 6 months of redesign, we piloted the newly redesigned curriculum in the classrooms around in one school in the city, and did a pretest and a post-test. And at the end of it, in the post-test, our kids, that is the kids in the middle school who did the pilot, outperformed all the other kids around the city who were also doing that particular curriculum, the Behavior Matters curriculum. And that was pretty exciting for us because we felt like, okay, we're onto something here. We have figured out a way to help the teachers understand pedagogically how to make the best use of the materials so that the materials can be accessible to kids who are non-English background learners and have low literacy skills without sacrificing the science. So that, as a postdoc, lit a fire under me, as you might imagine, and I've been doing work in that arena ever since. And that kind of solidified my sense of being a learning scientist, that postdoc in learning sciences in the Center for Learning Technologies in Urban Schools. Before then, I thought of myself as a kind of researcher who was very interested in literacy and thinking about the world in terms of content, but understanding the value of design and the importance of trying to make sure that whatever one designs really is accessible for users, and that you don't sort of stick with the design stubbornly if it's not working, if the affordances aren't apparent, if the affordances need to be modified to meet the needs of users, that design allows you an opportunity to do that. So as I said, I was kind of hooked. And over the years, I've continued to work at the intersection of literacy and STEM teaching and learning. Particularly with respect to today's topic, I'm very interested in the affordances of tools on and offline and the perception of and use of the tools. I'm really interested in how tools matter in terms of pedagogical improvement, curricular improvement, and in learning. And I see this work really as the support of literacy and STEM to achieve equity. And for those of you who don't know, I'm going to put in a plug for a book that we have coming out. Bridget Barron, Nicole Pinkard, Caitlin Kennedy, and I are co-authors of Cultivating Creative Producers and Digital Citizenship in Urban Communities, the Digital Youth Network, which is coming out through MIT this year, in the next couple of months. And this is a book about the Digital Youth Network in general and has quite a bit about Remix World in particular. So for those of you who are interested in that particular social learning network, that I think you'll find a lot to like in the book. So Frank, would you like me to start with the PowerPoint?
Yes, why not? if you have a link to that book, would also be good to post it. But if it's not yet out, but maybe it's already at some Amazon or something, so that we can have it in the chat. But then, of course, we are looking forward to the discussion where you refer to the slides. So the slides, I put these Dropbox links link again, and at the beginning of this chat we also have them as PowerPoints, so if you prefer the PowerPoints then you can download it from there. Let me use that opportunity to say hello to two more students that I see at the LMU, and also I think is there one more person at the University of Washington? You are so small in these thumbnails. And also Dan, if you'd like to introduce yourself quickly, but and then Kim, as soon as she gains control over the system again, she will start.
Hi, I'm Nancy Price. I'm the center manager here at the for the Institute for Science and Math Education.
Hi, welcome. So what I'd like to do is to point you to the PowerPoint, and if you look at the second slide, the second slide describes the research approach that Bridget Barron, Nicole Pinkard, and I used to document the Digital Youth Network over a 3-year period. And just to kind of give you a brief background, Nicole Pinkard designed an after-school, it was initially an after-school program that then morphed into having some integration with the regular school day. It was called the Digital Youth Network, and it was housed in a University of Chicago charter school. Bridget and I decided that we wanted to document the evolution of this work, and we were particularly interested in the use of new media literacies, the opportunity for kids who were working class and middle class kids on the south side of Chicago, 99% of whom were kids of color, to try to document how they came to be what Nicole hoped would be producers with technology and not simply consumers of technology, and learning to use the affordances of the various new media tools. So we followed one cohort starting with sixth grade over a 3-year period, and used surveys at the beginning in the fall and in the spring of every year to document their perceptions of their skills with new media, and to also to document actually what they were doing with new media as they learned to produce various sorts of videos and to write music lyrics and overlay those lyrics to produce music and other sorts of communications, to learn to use Remix World, which is a social learning network tool that you read about in the two articles that I posted. We observed on a daily basis what the kids were doing in the Digital Youth Network environment, and we created case portraits of these kids and tracked their participation on and offline, whether they were communicating from home on the weekends and the evenings, as well as their communication at school. In all of this, what I began to be really interested in was in what ways were and weren't the kids making use of the affordances that the technologies like Remix World offered, but also not just the Remix World technology, but the context itself. That is, the kids were in what was called pods, and each pod offered an opportunity for students to engage in interesting on and offline work. And some of the kids made good use of the affordances of having the physical environment and the students that they were working with on a every afternoon basis. And other students didn't make use of that affordance as well. And so I began to really wonder about what happens when affordances are present, but the participants either don't recognize them, don't know how to make use of them, mentors don't know how to display them, and other mentors do really know how to put them on display and to leverage them to support learning. And I just began to be really interested in that, and that led to focusing a specific part of the study on what the mentors were doing on and offline with Remix World, the ways that they were being trained pedagogically in the Digital Youth Network as mentors, and to try to draw some links between these things. And again, as I said, we did the case studies where we were really trying to track what kids were doing and analyze their work. So the third slide, it says Remix World Affordances. And as many of you know, Bridget's work has looked a lot at learning ecologies. And what I wanted to illustrate in this slide is the ecology, the ecology and context in which Remix World sat. It was connected with the media arts classes, the pods, that is the after-school context in graphic design, robotics, digital music, video games, and so forth, that that kids were participating in on a daily basis, and it was within this context that kids were moving in and out of these experiences, being exposed to the affordances, and sometimes making use of the affordances and sometimes not. And these were all, this was also the context that mentors themselves, that is the adults who were working with the kids on and offline, this was the context with which they could make use of the affordances in order to help support learning. And the slide after that really seeks to try to describe the kinds of affordances that kids were exposed to and mentors were exposed to. They were both cognitive, they were cognitive and learning affordances, so affordances that really spoke to the kinds of learning opportunities kids could engage in, and also the whether there was a specific kind of formal learning going on, the kinds of things that would cause students to reflect, analyze, evaluate, and then communicate with each other. There was the actual physical affordances I've described before of the tools on and offline, and the context itself that the kids were a part of, and then their perceived affordances. What were they aware of? What did they recognize that they were able to do with various technologies and with the curricular materials and other materials that they were exposed to? I have argued in the papers that these affordances really can support both consumption with technology, but also production, which I think is a much more, frankly, exciting sort of thing to look at, is how kids produce new media, what are the kinds of ways that they transform what they already find in media, the creation of new new materials, whether video or otherwise, and how they communicate, reflect, and analyze with their peers using the affordances that are available with technologies. So I'm going to stop here and see if there are any questions, and then I have an activity that I'd like to have everyone start with the first activity that's on the fourth slide that I'll connect you to shortly. But I want to stop here first and see if there are any questions.
So as I kind of look at the affordances of the kind of that last slide, I wonder, like, if embedded in there is kind of social capital affordances, like getting kids connected to novel people in the network that would be useful to their learning. I don't see it like foregrounded, so I was wondering if how you think about that within the work.
Great question, Phil. In Remix World, when we documented it, the social capital was quite varied. That is, some kids, through their middle classness, their parents' professional positions and so forth out in the work world, brought a social capital that allowed them to be able to make use of Remix World in ways that other kids did not. The mentors who were hand-selected by Nicole Pinkard were essentially the social capital brokers. for many students who did not have the requisite capital to be able to really recognize how to make use of the technology and the affordances. I don't highlight it here, but I think it is an important point that there certainly are affordances that there certainly are likely affordances that that would draw on your social capital and that perhaps require a social capital. I know that Esther Hargitay has talked quite a bit about the kind of there are actually tools that do leverage the social capital that's there and in some cases can build social capital in students such that they can communicate more readily and more productively with others. I think it's an interesting point, and I'm glad you raised it. Are there any other questions or comments? Okay, well, what I'd like to do is to start with the first question that is on the last slide. That's a bit of a conundrum, right? The first question that's on the last slide, the slide that says discussion, the question is, what affordances have your research and or project discovered that support critical substantive media production activity among students, teachers, or other users in and out of formal learning contexts that foster deep exploration of new media activities and that are easily leveraged by teachers and or by students to support learning? Is there anyone in the group who is not, has not or is not working with digital media and new media right now? If there is someone, I do have an alternative question that I can cut and paste into the chat. Okay, so seeing that everyone is working in this realm in some capacity, then what I'd like to suggest is take a few minutes in your group and think about your response to question one. Again, what affordances have your research and or project discovered that support critical substantive media production, et cetera? It's the first bullet and its sub-bullets on the last slide. And I will also, I don't know if formatting might be strange in the chat box, but it's not going to work very well. So hopefully everyone has the link to the slide. And I'd like you to come back in about 5 minutes and tell me what you've talked about with respect to the affordances.
Kim, sorry to interrupt you. Can you also paste the alternative question?
Yeah, we would also need the alternative question here, as most of us actually are at the very beginning of their PhD time or at their master time and have no experiences from their own work with it.
Kim, just to make sure that you are not talking without pressing the start broadcasting up button. Okay, this is the alternative question. Sorry for interrupting.
Yes, I'm pasting, I'm typing the alternative question now because for reasons I don't quite understand, it's not pasting. Sorry about that. The alternative question is, what affordances are present in the design work you do? If you're not doing any design work yet in work that you have been studying as a part of your program, do students, teachers, or others users perceive the affordances, and what do they do with the affordances to accomplish the goals that you've set for the work? So if you can take about 5 minutes or so and talk in your groups, that would be great. Thank you. Is everybody ready to resume the discussion, or do you need another minute or so? Okay, thanks, Phil. So, can we, sorry, LMU. Okay, just a minute. Okay, looks like everyone's ready now, is that correct? Thank you. So, can we hear from the folks at University of Washington, Phil and Veronica and Deanne, and just to kind of get a sense of what how your discussion went and what you talked about.
Sure. We're gonna piece together the conversation quickly. Veronica, you want to talk a little bit about like just the engagement with the text?
Sure. One of the things that we found is we're using iPads in a classroom right now with an app called Zydeco, and just the excitement that comes around using new technology in the classroom, even though it's a pretty familiar framework that students are learning across multiple tools, they're just so excited to be using it on really, relevant technology.
And DM, do you want to talk a little bit about the integration of the kind of local tools that the teachers are like in the
In our project, we've created two different courses, project-based courses, and we've integrated some technology-based, some media into the courses. But we also find that because we are working with a very wide range of school settings, where some schools have no access to computers or very limited access to computers, I should say, that's always a challenge in terms of being flexible with the curriculum. But we've noticed that when kids have access to technology in their learning, that there is this level of excitement and they for the kids, and that for them, they see it as a very sophisticated level of learning, that now they're learning in the 21st century as opposed to, you know, always the paper-based. So, you know, for us, we're trying to find out how to keep doing that and allowing students to have access to technology and computers and various other format, but that's the challenge.
We have kind of multiple projects on the floor that do project-based or problem-based learning approaches, and I think that, as an affordance, opens up a space for production in ways that can more easily have kind of meaning and accountability to audiences. The focus on actual professional work that people out in the world do is part of the strategy, and also kind of making it more interest-driven based on the learners' lives and their expertise. And one concrete example of that, we were using a protein folding game called Fold It, kind of in one of our genetics units, and a number of students who had gaming expertise lives outside of school brought a lot of their learning strategies about how to engage in that work into the classroom to like then do gaming for this purpose of learning about protein structure and function. So it was one of those bridging across settings kind of moments that worked quite well.
So it sounds like to me that what you guys are describing, one are these the sort of social capital that can be brought to a tool that leverages an affordance that's already present in the tool. That is the affordance is there, and if you have a certain kind of social capital, you can perhaps recognize that the affordance is there, so you perceive the affordance to be there, and then you also are able to leverage that affordance. And for those who don't have that background and set of experiences, the affordance can frankly just languish and really not be able to be leveraged for all that it could be. What I didn't hear you guys talk about, and I'd like to know more from your discussion, is the pedagogy in terms of what that it is a project-based or problem-based set of curricular materials. What's the pedagogical affordance there, or do you think of it in those terms?
Yeah, you know, I do think like part of the opportunity there, and we have actually different models that are, you know, in play in elementary school where kids are doing projects of a certain kind, and high school where the projects are a little bit more ambitious. And, you know, we have different projects that have different levels of resourcing, and sometimes we're building within kind of the structure of the school system. Sometimes we're able to kind of bring in additional layers of resources, and those all shape kind of the nature of the project-based work that goes on. I do think we see lots of identity shifts in the work for the students because of the kind of contemporary science nature of the project work that we're asking them to do and supporting them to do. So you see students like going into a particular problem area, doing work with a computer model of a particular kind, coming up against the limitations of the model in terms of what they're trying to produce, and then realizing that the scientists themselves are kind of hitting the same barrier because the mentors are in the space talking about that with them. And so they really feel like they're doing the work of science in these spaces in a way that's quite novel compared to what kind of pedagogy they have historically encountered in the space. And I don't know, DM, if you have...
That's very similar for us. We, in our projects, we do simulation, and so that means for students, they have the roles of oftentimes like being a scientist or being an attorney for, you know, so they take on these different roles, and so their task in all the different kinds of media, in the text that they learn, either in a textbook or in doing research or using online platform, is thinking like a scientist, and so that's their purpose, is to go and engage with the whatever medium they have as that particular role. So it's very connected to the curriculum, and it's not just, you know, go and Google something necessarily, but very much integral to the learning process.
Thank you. That's great. Would the folks in Munich like to talk next?
Well, we've been discussing about the questions you put into the chat and the ones you had in the slide. None of us is far enough in research and his project to really talk about what in his research happened, but, well, most of the time we were talking about a intervention I'm planning at the university level to support the scientific reasoning and argumentation skills of mathematics students, and about digital technologies that could be used there. But since this is a very unusual setting for students here, okay, Frank Fischer is on, okay, not now, okay, but since this is a very unusual setting, I'm not sure how fast they will accommodate to this technology and engage with it, and how much they're like really able to do so, but the technology would be really great for a enhanced visualization they can use. And yeah, that's pretty much it.
I just wanted to add, because I see the head of Carlos in the back, because we met before today. I think the question is more or less directly also addressing the games aspect of, so linking games and scientific reasoning. So what could be affordances in game settings that would support scientific reasoning and argumentation? So maybe that's something that you can still think about. I wanted to contribute one or two examples of our research, and also ask you, Kim, if this is an appropriate use of your use of affordances or perceived affordances. So we had one project where high school students worked in biology classes on green gene technology, and developed different perspectives on that, economic, ecological, and so on. And of course, what they had a couple of information locally in books and also in some repositories locally, but they also had a window to the web, so they had a Google access. And I wonder, because also the University of Washington people spoke about Google quickly, there is an empty window in Google, and this is more or less an invitation to ask whatever you like to ask. And so when the student had the task to come up with a position, a written position, their own position basically on green gene technology, the positive side, the negative side, then of course my impression was the perceived affordance is you can ask whatever you want because it's an empty field and you also get answers. So many of these students just typed in what are the advantages and disadvantages of green gene technology, and they received answers from pharmaceutical industry and from others discussing the pros and cons of green gene technology, and they just took these materials to produce their own position. So they copy-pasted a lot of arguments from there. What we did pedagogically was give them scaffolds, give them a kind of collaboration script where a learning partner had the task to and receive prompts that helped him or her to monitor what the other learner was doing with the results, the search results of Google. So I think another kind of affordance was needed then that helped them to appropriately work with the search results and not just copy paste it. So this is one example, and my question is this an appropriate use of the term affordances, perceived affordances in Google, and having the need of additional affordances? And if I may, I would add another example of our research. We had a project with teacher students and also in practice teachers. They worked on video cases, and they analyzed video cases of lessons, basically of lessons and courses, also in adult education and in schools. And they used little flags when they found things interesting, especially interesting in the video. And then afterwards, people were grouped, and those who were grouped received all the flags that were set by them individually. So they had the individual flags in different colors, and then they were asked to discuss about that. Freides was also working on this project for some time. And also I think this is that a good example for an affordance, for an affordance that helped people to produce their analysis, written analysis or audio analysis of these cases, and also affordances that supported groups to discuss the content on a higher level.
So yes, I think in both cases these are good examples of the affordances that are available in the technology, but also in the pedagogical approach that you used to facilitate learning. To start with the first one, which I think is a really intriguing one to me, I think that you had the physical, if you will, affordance of the Google space so that they could do the search online. And it's a really cool affordance, and it's the kind of thing that we all like to see because we like to see that students can make use of this affordance to go out into the world and retrieve information. The challenge I would suggest to you that was present, though, and I'm sure you've pondered this as well, is I made some notes to myself here, is that you had the presence of the window, but the learning and cognitive affordance, and I say them separately, the opportunity to learn and the cognitive affordance of analysis, reflection, evaluation of the sources and so forth, didn't appear to be as present in the in the forefront of the learner's perceptions. And so what you got then is a situation where learners recognize the physical affordance is there, that is the opportunity to go out into the world with the Google window, but they don't necessarily recognize and or have the skills necessary to be able to cognitively make use of the physical affordance in all the ways that it could be. There wasn't they needed either more pedagogy to support it, as you suggest, even perhaps beyond the stage that came after that, which was with the peer, helping the peer. They needed something before to help facilitate the kind of keywords they were going to look for, the search they were going to have, so the affordance was there. They could use that physical presence of the chat, the search board, in any number of ways, but lacking the skills and the lack of the affordance of the tool such that they could tailor their search and refine once they got the information to eliminate things that, you know, to do the, to apply an evaluation, the cognitive skills and evaluation and critique and so forth. I think that they were then left at a disadvantage. So the presence of the affordance was great. That is the presence of the search was great, but they needed more in terms of other affordances that would allow them to leverage and build on their learning skills and cognitive abilities. And that seems like that was lacking. And so by the time you got to the peer-to-peer interaction, they were already, many of the kids were probably already in bad shape because they had too much text, a cognitive overload, and they didn't have the requisite, they weren't using the whatever affordances were there in terms of the requisite tools to be able to narrow, refine, evaluate, synthesize, and do the answers to the questions that they needed to do in terms of their searching. So I think with the first one that one's intriguing because it has the affordances interacting with each other and with the users in all kinds of interesting ways. And the second one, I think, is a great example of making use of affordances in interesting ways. And it looks like that one may have been more successful. So Remy, would you like to? I want to ask: are there any other comments from LMU? If not, I'd like to turn to Remy. Okay, Remy, could we hear from you? Okay, Remy seems to be frozen. I'm not sure what's going on, but so if we can turn to the second question for those of you who are at the early stages, I'm going.
Just wanted to give Remy the chance. Sorry to interrupt.
Sorry, I didn't realize you were referring to me. I'm Chandan from UIC. Like the way I was interpreting affordance, sorry for joining late, and I hope this is in accordance to the way you were discussing it so far. So this is in the context of like a plumbing system simulator that students are using in order to make their 3D model of a home pump plumbing system. And like the two big affordances that I'm giving them for use is being able to manipulate the different variables. So they are able to keep all the variables constant and just manipulate one to see that variable's effect on the other variables. And this is in order to discover relationship between different variables. And the second is being able to explore different what-if conditions. So being able to, manipulate different variables, but this time with a focus on achieving a desired functionality for the model. So once they use the simulator, they move on to build their own 3D model of the plumbing system of the house using the construction materials that I give them. I'm not sure if this is in line with the way you were using affordance, but that's kind of the design work that I'm involved with.
Yes, I think it is. Can I probe you a little bit more to ask you what you see as the what you would see as the specific things that you want the users to perceive? Are they the ability to manipulate the variables and to use this manipulation to identify or showcase a relationship?
So the idea is that basically my focus is to help them engage with like the skills that engineers generally do engage with, like try to optimize a given design and then try to figure out like how much resources they need for their model, what's the right balance of how many pipes, how many 1-inch pipes they need as compared to how much 3/4-inch pipes they need. So they're trying to figure out, as they're manipulating these variables, they're trying to figure out like which is the most optimized answer that they can get at, because like the idea is like they need to understand that there's no right or wrong design. There's an optimized design which achieves the goals that has been set for them. So like that's what they're trying to get at. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Yes, it does. Thank you. And so I would say yes, that's certainly within the realm of what I'm describing as affordances. But I would want to push you even further to say, what are the other, those are the kind of, if you will, the physical affordances are there. And there's also the perceptual affordances in terms of what they perceive and what you're hoping they'll perceive as available to them as available uses for this tool. And then it sounds like to me that you've got some learning affordances there around their being able to get to the optimal level. And that's the piece that I'm still wanting to probe you on a little bit more to understand what are the various ways that learning is made possible, not just in terms, not just in terms of what things they can do, but what kind of learning could be going on in interacting with these tools, with each other, with the simulation and so forth.
Those are great questions. I was just trying to jot them down, but I definitely need to spend more time before I can answer them properly. So I think I'll need more time here before I can get back. Sorry.
Perhaps we can jump in there because another question popped up.
Well, it's actually not a question, is because of what Professor Fisher said before. So I think I really don't know how much he is expecting. He's still expecting an answer. The thing is, in the article we read for the webinar today, there are some interesting tools that are taken from gamification things. Actually, there are several, and it's quite interesting. I was looking how they managed to engage the people to use this software by using gamification, and how, for instance, the reward is not as expected, and it drops the level of interest. But concerning the video games, I think from a design perspective, in the video game industries, they will call the affordances mechanics, and it's what the game allows the player to do, and also they have constraints, which is what they are not allowed to do. I can even make a lecture, not from the part of the scaffolding, but the part Professor Fisher knows that I'm pre-classic, so Piaget and Vygotsky theories about how the game, a good game, I think most of my all professors in a game design will agree that a good game has to be have a good level of literacy and have these very good scaffolds and affordances. So I think any well-designed game will create some kind of reasoning, not necessarily scientific reasoning, but spatial reasoning or even a group cooperation, like is in that case for my thesis. So I hope it's it enlightens a little bit the conversation, even though it's not so directly related, but that's what I didn't intervene before.
Yeah. Oh, I think you're absolutely right, and I think it's quite related, and it prompts very interesting questions in terms of if the game should have, I agree with you, good games have those sorts of things. I think it's always interesting when you watch gamers play, or if you play yourself, that you might hear someone say, "Oh, I didn't know I could do that," and where "I didn't know I could do that" could be a shortcut or some other manipulation. Gamers go online and they are looking for all the tricks and shortcuts that are available to get to the next level and to win the to beat the game more quickly. Those are often affordances that the designer perceives are in the game itself, but that the user, the gamer, may or may, you know, some gamers may quickly recognize that the affordances are there, and perhaps that's some of the social capital they're bringing, or other sorts of things that allow them to perceive those affordances. And some gamers are not perceiving the affordances. And so one question might be, how clear and evident do the affordances need to be able to be in order to have them perceived? And is it necessary for all of the affordances to be able to be perceived? Is that part of the interaction with cognition and learning, that part of learning how to perceive the affordances that are present is that the learning to perceive it is part of the scaffolding inherent in the affordance of the tool? I'm not really sure. I think it's an interesting problem, but it is a design problem, and it's certainly a pedagogical problem to figure out how apparent particular kinds of affordances need to be in order to facilitate the kind of learning you want to have happen, and whether those affordances require, if you will, outside tools and pedagogies, like going to the web and looking for other information in order to be able to come back into the tool and be more successful. I think it's a really interesting problem. So, is there any other discussion about this particular point? Oh, I see Frank is.
Well, I just wanted to add to that. Thanks, Kim. Well, I think it would make sense, especially for your project, Carlos, but maybe also for others, to think about the affordances that are already there for a specific goal, for the variables that were mentioned already, for example, scientific reasoning. So, and really look at scientific reasoning. So is there any affordance in a game that is existing that would support scientific reasoning already, at least for some students who have the cognitive skill level for that? And what, from a pedagogical perspective, what types and kinds of scaffolds and affordances could be designed in order to increase the level of scientific reasoning, or support the students to identify a given affordance really as affordance for a scientific reasoning?
Frank, was that directed to me?
No, it was just adding on what you said, and it was more or less directly targeted at Carlos with the hat in the back.
Yeah, I'm professor here. Well, actually, I conducted my research with commercial video games, because it's like the area my supervisor wanted to explore the most, and well, me too. So we are, well, you know, of course, that I'm very classic, so I pretty much reading, not from the side of scaffoldings, but I am reading the game from the side of zone of proximal development, and I want to know how much people playing cooperatively this kind of games wants to develop their scientific reasoning. So of course we are making an analysis of all the scaffolds and all the affordances of the game, because if we don't do it, we cannot hypothesize which are the changes, or what are they developing really. So we are in the way.
That sounds really interesting. That sounds very interesting. Ken, I know it's 11:19, but I would like to put out one more question. Is that okay?
Yes, I think that's okay. And then I have one or two questions to you. Maybe the others have also more general questions, but I would have one or two. And then, I think another little task would be fine, at least from my perspective. What about the others?
Okay, I'm putting something in the task in the chat window now. It's a question around limitations of affordances and the implications of the use or lack of use of affordances. So those are two related but separate questions, really. So what do you perceive of as the limitations of affordances? We've done some talking today about them, and so you've done some reading. They probably are going to figure into work that you will eventually do. Some of you are doing work right now. So just talk amongst yourselves for a minute, or with yourself, about the limitations of affordances, and also the implications or the use of the use and lack of use of affordances, given the goals that you have for work that you want to do, or are doing. 2 minutes is fine. Thank you. Are we ready to reconvene, or do you need another minute?
Yeah, we were still really absorbed by the discussion. We were just discussing if you would like have to know about all affordances that there are in a game or some kind of digital environment, or if it would be nice to like get to know them over time to realize after 1 hour, oh, there's a much more intelligent or faster way to do something. That was what we were discussing about at the moment.
But we also switched it to the learning environment because, for instance, my perspective was that maybe in a game that's okay, but in a learning environment you will like that your students know all the affordances, like so they know what to do and they can use them appropriate. That's Stella's idea. They can use it in an appropriate way, and they can maximize their use. So, it's not only about the setting, but it's an interesting discussion actually. So we were very, very involved. Into that.
I've been thinking that it's nice that you, after like an hour or some time, experience. Oh, there's a more intelligent or a faster way, and this would give me like positive feedback that I achieved something that I now know more and can use this affordance now.
But for instance, my counter argument was that, for instance, when you solve a mathematical problem, you may have like three ways to do it, but if you learn one way, that's the way you use because the way you know and is the one that works for you, and you never really sit and think like, okay, I can use this other way. But if someone else teach it to you, you might use it. Yeah. But you never like try to discover it by yourself, like for instance in mathematics. So well, maybe in a game works, not in the academia. I don't know.
Yeah, well, we disagree on that point, I guess. But we also talked about the limitations, and one of the main limitations from our view was that the affordance has to be perceived and really understood afterwards, and that you would probably need someone or some digital artifact to engage with these affordances and to use them proactively.
I think this is actually a great discussion that you guys were having, and you've the two sides that you have pointed out, and the two big issues that one of you's on one side and one's on the other is exactly the pedagogical challenge, right? Because you could, as a mentor, instructor, whether online or offline, you could help the user or learner know quote everything there is to know about the affordance of the tool right away. But it does prompt the question. Even if you know all of the affordances of the tool right away, if you're a novice to the tool, or you know, even if you're someone who's used maybe other sorts of tools, but this one has some different affordances, can you really even make use of all of the affordances if you know everything that all the affordances that a tool can do, can you automatically just make use of it, or do you in fact need to be scaffolded into in a kind of zone of proximal development idea? Do you need to be scaffolded in? Can you know everything at once? Is it the best for you to know everything at once, or would you even be able to understand it? Understand all of the value that the affordances could offer. I don't know. I mean, I think it would be an interesting research and design problem if you gave a group of students for gaming, for example, if you gave a group of students who were comparable to another group in terms of levels of experience with gaming, if you gave them all of the affordances that you can possibly conceive that the tool can use up front, and ask and watch how they're able to advance and so forth, versus another group who gets the affordances in steps and perhaps even has to do some searching for the affordances, what's the difference in terms of the level of learning? And where learning isn't just about how quickly they advance or how far they advance in the game, but also from a cognitive standpoint, what did they learn about gaming, that sort of game, the affordances and so forth, as a result of having to go through a kind of ZPD? It'd be a really, really interesting set of design and research challenges.
I have a question that I had that in mind for now, I think half an hour, when I realized that, affordances can be considered as a kind of support structure, either more or less naturally occurring in a design or non-intentional design, non-intentionally designed affordance, or it could be intentionally designed. But if you start from help-seeking research, for example, and also starting from some scaffolding research, and I especially think of Friday's research in a mathematics education project, where we found that support that was intended to support the weaker learners actually especially support the stronger learners, those with better prerequisites. So a kind of Sesame Street effect, if you wish. So isn't it possible that the nice affordances that we design are also better used by those learners who would not even need them very much, and those learners who would need them very much will not be able to discover them? Or is this, would that indicate that we have the wrong approach to designing affordances, so we simply made the wrong type of affordances?
Such a great question. You're right. It is a conundrum. We could, in fact, for those of us who think in terms of issues of equity, we could, in fact, be creating much more inequity by virtue of the kinds of affordances that we're creating. That's one possibility. I'm not sure that it could be avoided perhaps by making the affordances more visible, or by creating pedagogies that help to make the affordances more visible. But in point of fact, some kids or some users are going to be several steps behind, and the gap between where they are and the catch up to those who already are fairly well versed and easily able to perceive the affordances because of experience or other kinds of knowledge that they bring to bear. You could very well create a more of an inequity. The affordances themselves, I don't think pose a disadvantage so much as the pedagogies that surround the affordances, or maybe the enhancements that need to be present in the affordances. That the affordances exist, they exist for sure. The question is, can they be enhanced? That is, I've seen, for example, in some reading tools, for example, or in some test-taking tools, that as the user answers a question, the next question is gauged to that, to the what the perception is of that user's ability. That's an affordance of a tool, and maybe there needs to be that sort of affordance and a link to a kind of pedagogy that will allow students and other users to be able to make maximum use of the in the moment learning that they're bringing to it when they're not so facile with the affordance to begin with. I think without pedagogy and other sorts of supports, one can close the gap completely between a very well-skilled user can do and do quickly in terms of perceiving the affordance and making use of it. I think that my machine went dead for a minute. I think that really requires either pedagogies built into the system that interact with the affordance to enhance the importance for certain kind of users, or you end up in a perpetual race where those who are not as skilled and don't bring the kind of social capital and learning experiences to the table are often at a gross disadvantage.
Yeah, I am just concerning the last part you said. I'm quite interested to know this perspective, because how much can you say that a very skilled person that pretty much knows how to spot all the affordances and use them is learning, or how much can you say that, like, for instance, from my perspective, like my background, I will say that only if there is an effort, like an active effort, either to learn a new affordance or to comprehend it, or even looking for one, or just being taught an extra one, well, that requires an effort, and that's where learning occurs, and that's where the subject can go like a step forward, like proximal development. I'm thinking in Spanish. So how is that a skilled player or a skilled student can just like use all the affordances? From my perspective, I think that person is already skilled and wouldn't be learning something new.
That's a really interesting comment that you've made, and I realize the person from UIC has not had an opportunity to jump in or to talk, and so I'll keep my comment very brief. The learning literature would suggest that I think that if someone isn't learning anymore, they're going to become disengaged, right? So if the very skilled person is making maximal use of all the possible affordances of an array of affordances that are available in the game, for example, either that person is going to probably engage in transformative activity where he or she learns to manipulate and use the affordances and the environment in new ways, or the person is probably going to get disengaged fairly quickly because there isn't any learning going on. But again, it's an interesting problem to see, depending on how you design in the affordances, how far and how long it takes for someone to not only make the traditional kind of blunt use of the affordances, Right, yes. So then creativity occurs because, you know, you sort of not just the, because it's not just about making the blunt uses of the affordances as the designer intended, but then engaging in a kind of Berider and Scartamelia transformative interaction with the affordances such that they are able to interactively do things that weren't expected from that particular set of opportunities. So then a kind of creativity occurs, which then affords some more and different and unexpected, perhaps, kind of learning. So I think it's all about how people keep pushing to get as far as they can get in all the ways that the affordances are possible, including the unexpected and unintended ways, while the person who didn't have all that sort of skill to begin with perhaps can remain engaged with learning how to use the various affordances and be engaged in learning as long as the affordances are present enough and scaffolded enough that the person doesn't get disengaged because it's just too hard and it doesn't look like it's the opportunities are there anymore.
Thanks, Kim. That was a really great answer. Like, I was kind of intrigued by those questions. So responding to your original question about the limitation of affordances, I'm perceiving limitations in a positive sense in my answer. So the affordance in my design is constraining the user to focus on a limited part of the plumbing system. And this is because my goal is to engage the students in the design process that an engineer typically engages with, and not actually focus on learning the entire, like, how to plumb your house. So what I'm doing with my design is constraining the parts of the plumbing system that the students focus on, and hence, like, getting them to attend to specific pieces of the system so that they can think more about trade-offs and design optimizations within those constrained pieces. That's how I'm interpreting the limitations in my affordances.
So that's an interesting linguistic shift, right? Because your limitations in this case are really about limiting what the users are able to see and do at a particular point in order to facilitate the kind of building of their design understanding of what engineers do. So linguistically that's very interesting. And I thank you for that, because it does point out that the limitation doesn't have to be something that is a negative constraint or challenge to the work, but instead in the design limitation, it limits what they're able to do as you're trying to move them along toward a particular kind of design understanding. So that's very interesting. Thank you for that.
Okay, so I think our time is nearly up. Before we have a fun round, maybe I would like to ask one question to Kim, especially with respect to recommendations for masters and PhD students, maybe especially PhD students who plan to work with technologies in their research. Given the fact that technologies develop very quickly, much more quickly than our theories, so we had a lot of references to the zone of proximal development, which is close to 100 years old, and we were discussing about technologies that are less than 15 years old maybe today. So what do you recommend to young scientists with respect to selection of technology and to integrate this technology into their research? Or also more generally, recommendations for PhD students who would like to work on the aspect of affordances and learning ecologies with digital technologies.
Well, Frank, you know, as you mentioned at the start of this webinar today, I did my training at University of Chicago, and at University of Chicago, we worship at the altar of integration of old theories into new things, and sort of the seminal, the recognizing the seminal importance of particular theories, and even though I've been out for some time, my way of thinking about that the world still is very much in that space. So I'm smiling because yes, the theories are very old, especially something like the ZPD, and the Leven-Winger situated cognition work is quite old, and Verreider and Scardamelia has become kind of an old theory as well at this point. But I think that for all of them, those theories and others in the learning sciences, and computer supported collaborative learning work, the world of that work, I think that it, in choosing technologies or in choosing to study the use of technologies, either to choosing to design, to study the use of, and to support learning within. I think that there are some key things to keep in mind. So first, what do you hope to gain from this work? So it's not about the technology in the first position, but the technology is a kind of tool, like a method is a tool, and you know, a methodological approach is a tool. It's not in the first position about the technology so much as in the first position about what do you want to know, and how do you think that any sort of tool will help you know that? Then, given what you want to know and the assumptions that you're making about why it's important to know that, then you can vet, if you will, different kinds of tools to help you. And this is in large part for the doc students. This comment, It can vet certain kinds of tools to probe them to see whether or not they're going to give you the kind of affordance as tool itself for beginning to understand and probe what you want to know. So I think then having done that, you can begin to try to think about, given what you want to know, what theoretical perspective helps you to begin to try to explain all of that. Because it's that marriage, that interaction between the question, you know, what you want to know, why you want to know it, what assumptions that you have about what you think you might find out, you know, because we all have assumptions, and putting them out on the table. If you use this kind of tool, what kind of assumptions do you have about what the user experience might be, what the opportunities might be for learning something? That's a really important thing, a set of things to ask yourself. And then, having asked yourself that question, then you vet a couple of different scenarios to see what kinds of tools are most likely to meet the research and design goals that you had in mind. For the master's students, I would say it's really thinking in terms of, given what's available to you, with respect to the kinds of tools that you can study, the kind of research that you can engage in or to document for your master's thesis, then what are your research questions, and how does a theory or the theories inform it? In my case, I often use the situated cognition perspective. I often use the zone of proximal development. And I often use learning theories more generally to try to begin to weave them together to tell a story about what I think is happening on and offline with the various sorts of tools that users and participants are using. So I would always say start with a question, start with what you want to know, start with why you want to know it, and start with the assumptions that you're making about what you might find out, and then see the tools as really a part of a package with respect to the methodological approach you're going to use to either document depending on where you are in your program, and the value that that particular tool or set of tools is going to give to you, given what you are most interested in learning about.
Okay, is there any immediate reaction or open question somewhere?
Yeah, Kim, I just wanted to say that what you just have said, I find it amazing. And it's pretty much like the way I used to do research. And I don't find it amazing because of that. It's just because I always thought that maybe I was a little bit crazy, but now I realize that I'm maybe not the only one. So I actually thank you very much. It was a very, very good support.
You're welcome. I know that there are times when we feel like we're a little bit crazy in the way that we approach our design and documentation work, but I do believe that there is an articulation between these sorts of elements that I've just described and our responsibility to the field writ large to be able to talk very specifically and articulately about how all of these pieces fit together in the work we're doing and what we've learned and the logic underlying it all.
Okay, thanks everyone. Thanks Kim, thanks a lot. I think maybe Carlos will visit you one day in the Naples network. This was a really fascinating project, the Remix World and others. I think what we learned today is to think in terms of ecologies and affordances when we talk about digital technologies, and also that we should really focus on using technologies more for production and less for consumption. I like also that focus in for projects that run in different places. Also, I think the affordances more or less turn our focus to more subtle hints instead of really explicit instruction, and I like that as well. And also, I think one of your main interests that came across through your written work, but also today, was how to use technologies to establish more equal participation of different groups of learners. And I think this is something that we should all be much more behind than we actually are. I like that in the discussion, I like especially that we were discussing about the extremes today as well. So very, let's say, weak learners or learners with a low prior knowledge or also a low status learners maybe in some groups. And on the other hand, very strong learners, very advanced learners, and how they can be supported by these affordances. I think in the end, what Carlos already emphasized as well is you refocused our attention to start from the research questions rather than from the technology. And I think this is a really very clear statement. I want to thank you very much, Kim, for taking the time. Thank everyone for participating in this webinar and hope to see many of you soon again. Last words by Kim.
Thank you, everyone. This has been so much fun. I really enjoyed meeting and talking with all of you. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Kim from Munich. We had a great discussion here, and I think one or the other person of us will take the ideas we got today into our PhD or master's thesis or something. Thank you very much.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks a lot, Kim. And like going back to the questions which you had asked me, I'd like to contact you offline about those questions, if you don't mind. Thanks a lot for the informative discussion.
Absolutely. Bye-bye, everyone. Have a good weekend and good rest of the week and holiday week as well. Bye-bye.